Coming up on Tech News Today, the Royal Canadian Mounted Police have the encryption key for tons of old Blackberries. Microsoft is suing the U.S. government for more public clarity of its data requests on cloud services. How it's not easy to erase your pepper spray incident with snake oil. Cell phones and cinemas might someday mix if you're a millennial. And Microsoft does AI again, and this time it's not racist. Yet, all that and more coming up next on Tech News Today.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Tech News Today is provided by Cashfly at cachefly.com.
This is Tech News Today, episode 1492, recorded Thursday, April 14th, 2016.
This episode of Tech News Today is brought to you by ZipRecruiter. Are you hiring? With ZipRecruiter.com, you can post to 100-plus job sites, including social networks, all with a single click. Screen, rate, and hire the right candidates fast. Try ZipRecruiter with a free 4-day trial now at ZipRecruiter.com/TNT.
And by Wealthfront. Wealthfront is a low-cost automated investment service and the most sophisticated way to invest your money. Whether you've got millions or you're just starting out, visit Wealthfront.com/TNT and sign up to get your free personalized investment portfolio. That's Wealthfront.com/TNT.
Hello and welcome to Tech News Today. This is a show where we talk about technology news with people who like to get up early and talk about technology, maybe in their pajamas. I am Megan Maroney.
We're not saying. I'm Jason Howell. Sorry, I've got coffee because it's just one of those days.
I'm pretending it's early for you.
Oh, boy, I just woke up like an hour ago. I live in Japan. What is going on here? Joining us today is someone who woke up an hour ago and lives in Japan, Patrick Beja from Freshspin.com, Le Rendezvous Tech, and weekly on the Daily Tech News Show. How's it going, Patrick?
Hey, guys. It's so cool to finally be able to be on the show.
I know. Japan is making so many things possible at this point.
Yes. We've been asking you for a long time. We've been setting our reminders. Remind him again. And finally, you're in a time zone where we are a perfect match for your desire to talk about technology. So.
Yeah, it's excellent. And as we were discussing before the show, I'm not going to deny that maybe part of the reason why I decided to come to Japan for a couple of months was that I could finally be on the show. So
I believe it.
There you go.
I believe it entirely. I believe that you are not telling us what we want to hear right now. Tell us a little bit about Frenchspin.com and, well, pretty much everything that you're working on right now for people who may not be familiar with your work.
I've been podcasting for a while. I've been, we first met Jason back at the Buzz Out Loud days. So
that's right.
I've been doing that for a long time. And I do shows in French mainly. You mentioned Le Rendezvous Tech, which is my French bi-monthly tech news show. I also do shows in English, mainly about video games and actually about international news with the Phileas Club. And both of those can be found at Frenchspin.com. If you're, interested in a different perspective about world events, then go check it out. It's a lot of fun that we have together every month or so.
Excellent.
Yeah, I always love to hear you on the Daily Tech News Show because you do have, with privacy and so many things that we talk about, we tend to have this very American centered idea. And I love how, it's really different the way that we see a lot of these things here versus overseas.
Yeah, it's usually we have some interesting debates, let's put it like that, about what should or shouldn't happen and what different parts of society should or shouldn't do, including, governments and companies. It's not always centered around this, but certainly it does make for interesting discussions.
It seems like more and more of these stories are cropping up. And wouldn't you know, today is no different. So it's a perfect day to get you on, Patrick, to get your perspective on some of this stuff, starting with BlackBerry. BlackBerry's long had a reputation for its superior security, something of importance to, the many business professionals, high-ranking officials, people who've all relied on BlackBerry's devices in the past. Maybe not as much now, but there was a time. But a case in Canada is revealing that the Canadian government has had access to the global encryption key for BlackBerry's devices, extending back as far as 2010. The government has been fighting for 2 years in this case to keep this information from hitting the public record. A technical report that's part of the filing shows the Royal Canadian Mounted Police confirming it had, quote, the key that would unlock the doors of all the houses of the people who use the provider's services, and that without their knowledge.
Canada.
Doesn't this sound familiar? Sounds so familiar. I feel like we were just talking about this with a company called Apple just not too long ago. Very, very close.
It's super funny and interesting and ironic. There are so many elements of this that we want to discuss. I would love to talk about this, only this, for an hour. But basically, they've had it since 2010. It doesn't apply to companies that have their own BlackBerry servers, so those are safe. But still, one of the facts that came out that I really love about this case is that at some point, the court was discussing revealing the key as part of the discovery process, publicly. And I love that that was even a thing. They were like, wait, okay, let's just wait a second. If you reveal it, then this is the global encryption key for all of the devices in the world, right? So it would enable anyone who would see that key to decrypt any message from any BlackBerry on the planet, including in the US, which I think makes for an interesting additional piece of information in this, as I'm not sure how the US officials would react to their messages able to be decrypted by this magic universal key to every home in every part of the world. Maybe BlackBerry has changed it since then, and we don't know quite how the police has obtained it. So it's possible that it wasn't BlackBerry that actually gave it to them as part of the legal proceedings. But if it is BlackBerry that gave it to them, I think it's going to be a pretty tough hit to recover from PR-wise.
Yeah, I definitely think this feels like the nail in their coffin. As Jason said, it's not government or businesses that the key, one of you said this, it's not the business or government key, Patrick, that you can get. There is this idea that people have that BlackBerries are more secure, and they're just not, unless it was in a certain period of time. Because it does say, like, between 2010 and 2012, they had access to it.
Yeah, and I think it has something to do with older versions of kind of the BlackBerry OS. Now, at this point, also consider the fact that, BlackBerry 10 is kind of going away, if not already away. So I don't know of the relevancy of this encryption key necessarily for current devices. Like, I doubt this has any sort of impact on, let's say, the BlackBerry Priv, the Android version. And BlackBerry's going to release a couple of more Android devices before they decide whether they're going to continue with the hardware game for good or not. This might have some sort of influence over that, but I think it's a pretty big black eye to have based your company around security and this perception that you are the secure platform, and then to find out after the fact that, for quite a few years then, this supposed, secret private key, literally the key that opens up all of these devices, wasn't really so private because the RCMP had it. They had that key, and they could use it at will as need be.
They used it, apparently, one of the big elements. It's impossible not to reflect on the case, on the San Bernardino case, when you hear this. But one of the elements there was that they would only use the key for this specific phone in this specific case. That argument didn't hold very long, but still, it was part of the conversation. And here, apparently, the Canadian police used it to decrypt millions of messages. So it sort of, you can read it however you want, but I think it sort of lends credit to the idea that if they do have the key, they're probably not going to limit themselves to just this one thing and nothing else. So it's not, again, it's sort of a chilling moment when you realize what's been happening.
How about a little like turning the table, a little upside here? When the whole Apple FBI thing was happening, the constant discussion always kind of centered, eventually at some point touched on, well, if this exists, then it's going to eventually inevitably fall into the wrong hands. This was a pretty important piece of data that existed in somebody else's hands, whether they were the wrong hands or not. I guess that's open to interpretation. But it, as far as we know, it never got out from there.
How would we know?
Yeah, I guess we wouldn't know, though. So you're right. So I don't know. I'm just trying to find the other angle.
No, you're right. It's a good point. It's a good point.
Yeah. I mean, I was just in D.C. and I have a couple of friends that work in the State Department, and they were in the process of moving finally after many years from BlackBerries to iPhones. I mean, and they had hung on to those BlackBerries forever. And, you know, as part of like the infrastructure and this idea that they're just more secure. But yeah, I mean, they're obviously not. Well, moving on, we have all considered it once or twice, throwing a little money at a company that might erase some of the less flattering things about ourselves that have shown up on the internet. Well, according to documents obtained by the Sacramento Bee, UC Davis spent $175,000, that's taxpayer dollars, in an attempt to erase online existence of the fact that they pepper sprayed students and alumni at a peaceful protest in 2011. Now, while they couldn't actually remove the references, the university paid a company called Nevins and Associates $15,000 a month for an online branding campaign designed, quote, to expedite the eradication of the references to the pepper spray incident. So I don't know how they thought they were going to get away with this. It is fascinating, though. I mean, and it brings up the other thing that is different overseas about the right to be forgotten. What do you think about this, Patrick?
I don't think, well, yeah, the right to be forgotten is a whole other bag of something. I don't think here it would apply. No reasonable anyone would decide, you know, oh, you want this to go away, then we will just erase it, because it's not, you know, in anyone's interest. It's in everyone's interest for this story to remain as it is, which it should be. It's sort of interesting that they would pay that much money for people. It makes me think of snake oil sales people. Mm-hmm. Like, yes, and this program that we have will remove any instance of any bad story about you, and also it will cure your ailments and it will make you stronger. And you're like, oh, guys, I will give you money now. So I don't know how they even, you know, I think this is indicative of sort of a larger trend of generational differences. I hope it's generational, but tech education is so important. And I'm not talking about learning to code, as a lot of people are advocating for in schools. That might be important. But I think the most important thing is understanding how tech works. It's part of our world today. And not knowing, you know, even entertaining the idea of disclosing an encryption key is the kind of thing that you know should make people jump out of their seats. And here as well, it's kind of, how could you fall for this? What did you think was going to happen? This was, you know, it's kind of a big story. You're not going to make it disappear. You should know that, if anything, you should know that those stories exist and stay. And you should act accordingly beforehand.
I guess my reference to the right to be forgotten, you know, that this is the essential problem with the right to be forgotten. The only people that even attempts to work for is like the people that have all the money. You know, like, you're right. Like, they could not have gotten rid of this. But the essential problem with the right to be forgotten is that companies who could throw money at the problem could possibly, not if they're UC Davis, not if it was as popular a story as this, as damning a story as this. But, you know, it never really works for the little guy who it works for.
Sure.
So actually, I would argue that this, you know, the big companies that have a big scandal or, you know, a moderate sized issue, it's going to be difficult for them to, in the case of the right to be forgotten, it's going to be difficult because the way it works is that the European government has tasked Google with deciding whether or not it is in the public interest to see that thing disappear. If there is a right of information, then usually they decide not to make it disappear from their index. Whereas for the little, you know, the little guy who has done something silly and not, you know, overly criminal 15 years ago, and who doesn't want that thing to show up as the first result on Google 15 years later, might get it removed on the Google index. I don't think it would apply to the big companies, though. So this is one case where it kind of might work for the little guy more than for the big company, I think.
Every article written on this topic, by the way, has the words UC Davis and pepper spray in the title. How's that for SEO?
Yeah.
And not to be callous, because I realize I'm going to go more the humorous route here, but the meme is kind of awesome. So at least we have that, the pepper spray meme that kind of came out of this.
Well, we have it all. We have everything. Everything went away.
We win. Yeah, apparently. It's unfortunate, obviously, that the incident happened. And it's very interesting I think you're absolutely right in calling him snake oil, salesman or whatever. The consultants literally said they would, quote, eliminate the negative search results. We're going to take them all off the internet. We're going to get rid of them all. You'll be just fine with us. That apparently did not work.
Well, you know, it's like you said, it is such a shame that it is, that this is a place of learning in California.
Yeah,
that also, like, California schools, like, have no money, that they're spending all this money on that, wasting all this money. It's totally hubris that they mm-hmm. think that they can do this. Because you're right, now that I think about it, because there have been cases of the little guys. I mean, I'm thinking of Lindsay Stone. I don't know if she was the woman that took that unfortunate picture at in Arlington in front of the cemetery, where it was said silence and respect, and she was screaming and giving the finger, and then that picture was everywhere. It was like something that she did as a joke, which isn't funny, but she thought it was, and it was
everywhere.
And
the way the internet works.
Yeah.
Yeah, once something catches fire, it's hard to stop it. Yeah.
Right, and so what they did, I mean, is she hired, like, somebody actually went, and hired I heard this on the Reply All podcast, great tech podcast, they hired one of these companies to just, flood the internet with positive things about her, because she was actually a good person. She worked with learning disabled people. She was on a trip with learning disabled people when she took this unfortunate picture. But they just, just flooded the internet with things about how, blog posts and things that she had done, and just like her thoughts on fashion. And the truth is, for the little people, if you do that, you most people don't get to the third page of searches. So if you're just an average person that made a mistake, you can do that yourself, sort of just, fix the search engine up so that you don't look that bad.
But pepper spraying the students, probably not a good idea.
And then trying to hide it.
That's probably going to stay.
Stick around a little bit longer. All right, so drone racing super fans, things are about to get a bit more mainstream here. ESPN, the sports cable network here in the U.S., signed a multi-year international media distribution deal with the International Drone Racing Association. I love this. The first event that ESPN will showcase is being held August 5th through the 7th in New York City. ESPN3 will stream the event live, and ESPN will televise a one-hour special of the event. Kind of the extension of drone racing. This is what's so impressive to me about this. The first ever U.S. national drone race happened 8 months ago, and now deal with ESPN. This like new, almost internet-enabled sport is going to burst onto the scene. And I say internet-enabled because, by all accounts, Mike Murphy, of course, who wrote this article, we've had him on plenty of times, has said this in the past. It's not the most fun thing to watch when you're actually sitting there in stadiums. So charging up people to actually go there and watch, it's kind of a challenge because these drones are so tiny, the track is so big and everything. But what's so amazing about this kind of sport, if you want to call it a sport, is kind of the first person portrayal of the drone going through the course. That's how they actually race these things. They put on, kind of like VR goggles, and they're seeing first person, almost like it's a video game. And seeing that after the fact and being heavily produced, almost as a cinematic experience as opposed to a mechanical sport or something. So I'm very interested to see how ESPN treats this because, are they going to go the VR, the kind of first person VR route? I would hope that they would. But I'm really looking forward to it. What do you think about this, Patrick? I'm excited.
Yeah, I think it looks super awesome. And with people getting VR goggles now, well, there are delays in delivery, but with the Oculus Rift and some people getting them, it could even become something as well. Maybe not this time because ESPN might not be equipped, but at some point it could become a thing. And it looks so impressive. You're right. When you just look at it from the stadium, it's okay. When you look at it first person perspective, it looks like Star Wars, speeder race. It's incredible. And on the other hand, I also think that, ESPN has been doing super interesting stuff in the past few months, in spite of some of the comments by some of them anchors. They've been doing interesting things with esports as well. So I think they're looking for ways to maybe attract a younger audience, possibly. And this would get me interested, possibly, in watching ESPN if I could, if I was in the U.S., where I would never watch it for the regular sports bowls things, you know, football and baseball and all of those. So, yeah, I really like that they're open to the idea of, you know, integrating new things that are not traditionally looked at as proper sports by maybe the, you know, Sunday barbecue crowd.
I think what's interesting about this is just our seeing through the screen is really the only way to see it. I mean, there, you know, if you're there, if you're a spectator at the sport, it's only a little thing really far away.
It's a tiny little dot. It's like a little fly off in the distance.
At all. And it just, you know, with so much virtual reality, so many screens, it's like, are we going to be interested in seeing things in real life at all anymore? Because this is a sport that you wouldn't want to go see it. I mean, unless you wanted to hang out with the other drone racers, like there's nothing to see. It's way better to be at home with your VR goggles on.
Yeah,
to watch.
It just makes me wonder what other sports can we firsthand view, POV view do, like, you know, football down on the field, something like that. I don't know.
Or that would actually be prediction time. I think it's going to happen. You're going to have these kinds of things possibly happen with VR goggles, and then after people puke, you know, after 30 seconds of watching it, they're going to stop. But
wait, maybe that was a bad idea.
Yeah, but no, going there, and you go there for the fun camaraderie with everyone, but then in order to watch the thing, you put the VR goggles, so you have you know, crowds of people just in the stadium with the VR goggles watching the race. I think that's a brilliant idea.
That's super nerdy, but super awesome. I'd totally do it. I'd be there in a heartbeat.
Well, speaking of virtual reality, all this week I've been reading headlines about the world's first virtual reality surgery that was supposed to happen today, but Quartz reports that while this surgery happened, they forgot the virtual reality part. Here's a story. A tumor was removed from a colon. It was recorded. It was recorded in 360 degrees, and it was broadcast throughout the world. You could even watch it with your Google Cardboard. But does that make it virtual reality or augmented reality or just old-fashioned reality that we can watch from different angles? Now, Quartz makes the claim that virtual reality has to be computer-generated. Do you guys agree with this?
Well, yeah, this is 360 video. It has nothing to do with virtual reality. I mean, I guess, you know, virtual should not exist, right? It's something that is literally virtual that doesn't exist in real reality. I guess in the sense that you are, your presence is projected in that space where you're actually not. It can be considered that you have virtual presence. Maybe that's a better word for it, your virtual presence reality. But it certainly isn't. Yeah, it isn't actual VR. It's got nothing to do with AR. But it's still cool. It still seems like something that would be super interesting to live through, and something we're going to have a lot more of as VR goggles get more and more common. And that's the thing, I guess. You need a VR goggle to experience this properly. You could watch it on your screen, but it's not going to be the same. So maybe that's why the VR angle comes from. But yeah, it's not virtual reality. That it isn't.
You could watch it without goggles by crossing your eyes if you have the split view. I'm just saying. I don't know if I recommend that, but I do that every once in a while. It seems to kind of work. Yeah, I've always called this immersive video as opposed to virtual reality, because I kind of agree. I feel like virtual reality is kind of like the computerized aspect, but you make a really good point as far as virtual presence, because that's kind of what you're doing. You're putting yourself in a place where you are not, and maybe that's where the virtual comes from. Having said that, I feel kind of bad for the person whose colon is now famous, broadcast
for
all over the world.
Reality.
Yeah, for immersive video.
Well, I think he probably had the choice.
I'm hoping
he signed a release.
I know. Are we going to have to worry about our surgeries being televised? That's all I want to know.
If he didn't sign the release, then no problem. If he pays me $15,000, I can make all of this disappear from the internet.
I can remove my memory of the colon.
Yes. Yeah. Okay, sign up for that.
All right. And finally, up until now, cell phone usage has been discouraged in cinemas with pre-movie trailers. You know these trailers. They're telling you to silence your phones, be kind to fellow moviegoers, all that kind of stuff. But the younger consumer, the modern age, lives their lives inside the smartphone, or so they say. And asking them to resist the urge to touch their phones during the movie could potentially turn them off from the movie-going experience altogether. AMC Entertainment's new head, Adam Aaron, told Variety that AMC is looking at ways to get millennials, he says, interested in movie theaters the way their parents have been. And one way to do that would be loosening the cell phone restrictions during a movie. Right now, I mean, it's totally, you know, pretty much restricted. Like, you know, like how many times I've been in a movie and I'm watching and then there's that like bright whitish, bluish, sharp light from the corner of my eye and it's someone checking their text. I find it annoying. It kind of pulls you out of the experience. But he says that, you know, he likens telling a 22-year-old, this is his example, to turn their phone off is like telling them to cut off their arm, which is a serious way of putting it, I suppose.
People were not happy about that. Like, I think that's the big problem. Like, a 65-year-old is saying, like, here's what millennials
yeah,
like.
Yeah, I know. And when I was reading it, I was like, do you know? I mean, I don't know.
Great. Yeah, it's really like hyperbole, but it's just,
yes,
come on. It's, I think, you know, first of all, it's, I think the experience of going to the movies in the US and in Europe is already kind of different, at least for France, where I usually live, except now I'm in Finland, but it's the same. It's very quiet. People don't talk. You don't have, you know, people using phones at all. Every time I've been at the movies in the US, it was much less enjoyable because people were more, I don't know, not rowdy, but they were less respectful of the experience itself.
Go ahead and say it. It's okay.
Yeah,
it's
all right. A little bit. It feels like that is for sure. But for me, at least, I'm not speaking for everyone else. But if that sort of became the norm, that yeah, you know, we want to attract the millennials, so we're going to make it okay for them to use their phones, then I would stop going, and I go a lot. I think they would turn off the older generation. So maybe wait a little bit longer so that the older generation doesn't matter as much and then you want to attract the millennials. But no, it doesn't seem like a good idea to me at all. If anything, the movie theater's strength is to give you an experience that's different from being in front of your TV and playing Angry Birds as you're watching the movie. Put that phone away. I'm turning into angry old person now.
I think that he was also talking about separate movie yes, theaters or just text only
yeah,
shows.
Like,
But yeah, they got a lot of backlash. People got really angry about that.
Because we've all been there. You know?
Maybe they could test it. Actually, I'm rushing my judgment. Maybe test it in a few theaters where it's okay to use your phone and see what happens. My suspicion is it's not going to go well.
Yeah, my Apple Watch sometimes goes off and I just get really embarrassed. Like I've forgotten and I just cover it up.
That's because you're like us. We're all old. The kids, would you cut off your arm? No. Well, apparently it's exactly the same thing. So they would love to keep watching their
I have to say though that I saw Kevin Hart in Oakland in a giant stadium. And they said no cell phones. You'll be kicked out if you use your cell phone. And there were people that were kicked out. Like they took them up and you know kicked them out. They were angry and yeah, I mean because it's disrespectful, especially in a live performance. Totally disrespectful.
Yeah, I mean there's the perception from a certain group that it's disrespectful, and I think that's the thing that this is all kind of centering around is that potentially what he's saying is that there is a certain group of people, aka the older people or the people who are used to one thing, that find that disrespectful. And then there's an entirely other group that is just kind of normal. So it's not actually disrespectful to them. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I mean, I feel like I'm open to trying something out, like he was saying, a different section or maybe even a whole other auditorium. So like mm-hmm. you have two showings of Zootopia and one showing is texting allowed and the other is not. I don't know. I don't know if that actually, you know, ultimately is the thing that brings millennials to the movie theater either. Like, is the reason they're not going because they can't text in the movie theater? Probably not.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe it's a component, but I doubt it's the whole reason.
That sounds measured and reasonable, so I'm going to disagree. No.
Well, after the break, Microsoft is suing the government to make them tell us when they're digging through our emails in the cloud. But first, let's take a minute to thank ZipRecruiter, the sponsor of this episode. Now, the upside of people being able to text in movie theaters is that if you're looking for a job or if you're hiring, now you can head to the movies, watch all four of Avatar's sequels, and manage your hiring search right on your mobile device. If you want to find the perfect hire, you need to post your job on all the top job sites And now you can with ZipRecruiter.com. You can post to 100 plus job sites, including social media networks like Facebook and Twitter, all with a single click. We talk a lot about the importance of hiring a diverse workforce, especially in the tech industry. The right employee might not look like you. He or she might not look like the people that your company has hired in the past, but that doesn't mean that they're not the right person for the job. And you'll never know unless you find them. If you want to find the perfect hires, you have to look further than your own personal friend and family network. ZipRecruiter can take the pain out of all that searching. Find candidates in any city or industry nationwide. Just post once and watch your candidates roll into ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use interface. No juggling emails or calls to your office. Quickly screen candidates, rate them, and hire the right person fast. Find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by over 800,000 businesses. Right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free by going to ZipRecruiter.com/TNT. That's ZipRecruiter.com/TNT. And we thank ZipRecruiter for their support of Tech News Today. So big news today, Microsoft filed a new lawsuit in federal court on behalf of customers and businesses. In a company blog post, President and Chief Legal Officer Brad Smith said customers have the right to know when the government requests access to the information they store on Microsoft's cloud services. Smith says the issue revolves around three things. Transparency, requests should be transparent as much as they can without hindering investigations. Digital neutrality. Now, we know when the government is searching our file cabinets, we should know when they're searching our emails in the cloud. And necessity. The government should have access to only what is necessary for their investigation. Seems reasonable. What do you think, Patrick?
It certainly does. I'm probably on the side of the tech world in this, but there are so many interesting things in this case. It doesn't seem like it's a timely thing for Microsoft. There doesn't seem to be a specific issue right now that they need to address. So I have to wonder if they didn't draft this on the heels of the Apple issue in order to make sure that they have some kind of sympathy from the public. But, you know, more generally, first of all, I think it's very important to mention that we all understand and know and agree that terrorism is terrible. And a lot of those are centered around the idea that, you know, we need to do this to stop terrorism. And we all, you know, as a French person, we've had two terrorist attacks in the past year. So I understand this very well. But there's also, I think, what I call the 9/11 hangover that is sort of going away a little bit, and reason is coming back. And the lengths to which the government and surveillance agencies have gone seems like it goes beyond what would have been accepted before 9/11 happened. And I understand we live in a different world, and certainly we do, but we might need to bring it back a little bit. I always like to reference that when we talk about these things. There was a great TV show called The Wire, where they were spying on drug dealers, basically, and the lengths they had to go through to get a judge to accept their demands for surveillance were incredible. And that was a very realistic show. It was done by a person who named Dan Simmons, who followed all of these things very closely. So the point I'm trying to get to is that what seemed reasonable before would seem impossible to implement today because it was too restrictive and too protective of the general public, and the rights were protected like in a way that we wouldn't believe today. And that was only 15 years ago. I think we've gone so far that it's time we scale things back a little bit. And I think that's what Microsoft is asking for here. They're not asking for things that are completely unreasonable. They understand that we need to do things differently than we did before. But certainly, because of the emotional response we've had to terrorism, some people think that we've gone too far. And it's time to re-examine this now that this has become normal, you know, the normality. Now we have to live with terrorism. It's not exceptional measures anymore. So let's look at it and let's, with in a more quiet environment, with more reasonable thought and time to process all of this, examine what we need and what maybe we don't need so much.
Feels like, especially in the past few years with the Edward Snowden revelations and all, you know, the kind of tsunami of changes and awareness and all that kind of stuff that's brought. Along with that has been a heavy dose of people. I don't know if the word is complacent, But people just kind of accepting and just kind of being like, well, I know it sucks. I know there's all this stuff going on. I'm literally just one person. And there's a mountain of stuff to even go up against. Where do you even start? Feels hopeless. I'm not going to, you know, ultimately people don't end up really doing a whole lot about it other than complaining about it. And I think the positive side that what we're seeing right here, and maybe this, you know, this kind of woke this deem this, I don't know the analogy, but something has woken up out of the Apple FBI case, which is that tech companies realize that they have a public perception that they can tap, like they can tap into that public perception, the power of the public support, the public by and large that has not had a whole lot of power or influence over a lot of this stuff. At the same time, kind of saving their bottom line, and they have a lot of power right now. They have a really great way to reach a lot of people and make some change finally after, you know, this long 9/11 hangover that we've experienced for years and years. So I'm kind of happy to see that, right? That companies are actually kind of using their voice and their influence to step up and see what kind of change they can make. You know, Twitter, I think this was like 2014, and it's still going on. They sued the Department of Justice to try and get some sort of capability to reveal in more than just 1,000 number chunks how much of their information has been requested or subpoenaed from the government and that kind of stuff. So more and more they're feeling empowered to go after and sue the government for just more clarity. And I think that's great.
Yeah, I mean, that's part of why I wanted to discuss this, because I mean, I don't know if the average person really understands that the government can ask Microsoft and we don't have to even know. We don't have to know. The only reports, those transparency reports, are just how many requests they've gotten. Mm. We don't know. We don't have to know that they're looking at our stuff. They can look at it for as long as they want. They don't have to have a specific reason. They can look at as much as possible. So I think what Microsoft is asking is not that much. Just we should be able to tell people in some instances, if it wouldn't hinder the investigation, it should be a limited amount of time, and they shouldn't be able to just blanket look at everything. Mm-hmm. Your point is fascinating, Patrick, about how, you know, it does seem like they maybe are going on the coattails of Apple. But what a difference from when, you know, Tim Cook came out and wrote that letter and everyone was just like, yes, Tim Cook, I support Apple. I mean, not right away. The big companies weren't, but people were, especially. But, you know, Brad Smith, it's just like he wrote this and it's like, you know, just sort of landed. There hasn't been a ton of people just saying yes.
Immediately, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess over the next couple of days, we'll probably see a little bit more of that. I mean, there are certainly companies that stand to benefit from support. You know, Amazon has huge cloud infrastructure. I would imagine that they probably support a lot of what Microsoft's talking about here. Box has already kind of come out and voiced support in a kind of a limited way, but we're starting to see a little bit of that, and I have a feeling we're going to see a lot more.
Yeah, I think it's going to come. I mean, remember for the Apple thing, you're right, Megan. For the first couple of days or 3 days, it was very tepid. It took a little while for the tech companies to show their support. And I think it's natural because you want to weigh everything that you can before you answer on something that important, right? You want to weigh the actual legal benefits. You want to weigh the public perception, the PR aspect. And I'm sure that even some companies are thinking, you know what? We already did this for Apple. Do you want to hammer that nail as many times as this? Like, it's just happened. Maybe let's save our strong public support for other things. It's possible. But yeah, I think this is also something that we're going to see a little bit more support for in the future, and they all stand to benefit from it. So, I it wouldn't surprise me if it started trickling in the next few, let's say next week or so.
Mm-hmm. I mean, part of the criticism against Microsoft for not coming out right away, and of course, Bill Gates sort of came out and then he said, that's not really what I said. And, you know, I'm not sure if I support Apple or not. But I mean, Microsoft has tons of government contracts. That's a lot of their business. And so, you know, this means a little more coming from them, because, I mean, I think they're risking more because so much of their business does come from government contracts as opposed to Apple.
Yeah. For sure. All right. Do we move from something weighty to the Amazon Echo Tap?
Speaking of government surveillance.
Yeah, hey, there we go. That works. I'm not sure if it does. We don't know the
Let's
answer to that.
Not.
But Michael Goldstein wrote in to TNT at twit.tv regarding our discussion yesterday on the Amazon Echo Tap. Michael writes, I believe the Amazon Echo Tap was underappreciated in your April 13th discussion of the device. The Tap has a battery and is a mobile device. There is great versatility in being able to move an unencumbered by electrical cord and or external speaker Echo around the house. You can place it in a guest room, for example, when you have visitors. There's also the possibility of having the device in the garage when you're working on a project and you need technical help. Of course, you're going to have to tap it in order to get that help. Or placing it on a patio table for entertainment value, assuming your Wi-Fi extends that far. I wouldn't mind having the option of switching on a voice-activated mode, but considering the number of times my kitchen Echo has been activated by slips on podcasts, I'm not sure the touch feature is really a disadvantage. Perhaps just venting here. For me, for the above reasons, I find great value in the Tab and consider the $130 price reasonable for the capabilities offered. On the other hand, I'm finding it difficult to see value in the Dot for the $90 price. $50 would seem more reasonable given what is required for its use. That's electrical connection and external speaker. But I'll keep an open mind as reviewers and users explain how the Dot is proving its value. Users... And, but not viewers, but users like Megan.
Mm-hmm. I was a little critical of the Tap yesterday. I just thought, well, why do you need that? I mean, you have a phone. I mean, your phone, if you have an Android phone or, you know, any phone, you can press the button and ask Siri or Google Now or Cortana, anything that seemed to be the same thing. I know that I personally find that the Amazon Echo answers better, has more capabilities in terms of home automation. But so, yeah, I get it. And I understand why you have to tap it, because we don't want to have like people bringing around a mobile speaker where they might be always listening to us.
Yeah. There were a lot of people that liked the thought of an Echo, but, you know, didn't necessarily want it to be always listening, even though, you know, to some degree, I wonder if always listening is interpreted as one thing when it's actually something completely different. You know, it's not quite as scary as maybe people think it might be, but hey. They've got an option now. Do you have any of the Echo family in your life, Patrick? What do you think about them?
No, I don't. And it's a device that got a sort of a tepid response initially. And in the past few months, I've heard more and more people saying it's actually absolutely awesome. And a lot of people love it. I'm curious, though. Does it work better? You sort of implied it did, Megan. Does it work better than the other digital assistants, virtual assistants? Because if it doesn't, I'm not sure, you know, Siri doesn't work super well for me and I end up not using it that much. But if the dream of that thing is very appealing. So if it does work better, I would like to know.
Well, it does. I mean, it works with certain apps, like it works with Pandora, where you can't, you know, Siri doesn't really work with Pandora. It works, I can ask it for the news, I can ask it for the weather. You know, Siri is sort of limited to Apple, things that it can do, Apple Music, or, you know, Siri never answers my questions, but.
Siri isn't listening. it seems like it works. You have to work a little bit too hard at it, but if everyone's been saying that the Echo works well, so if it does, I would understand why the Tap could be an interesting product. And we were talking about, I mean, you guys were talking about the Kindle a couple of episodes ago, and I believe that you said that the Kindle was a cool device because it was a one-use, you know, dedicated device. I think that's the same kind of appeal for the Echo and the Tap as well. Yes, you could launch your app on your phone or you could try and call it, but it doesn't, you know, the button you have to press and the unlocking and the thing, it's kind of cumbersome. But if you have the Tap right there, you press it and it works. I think the single-use device aspect of it is also what makes it interesting.
Yeah, I mean, you don't have to have your phone around for home automation. You know, if you're going to be turning off and on your lights with your phone, you always have to have your phone with you. But, you know, if you have one of these in every room, which is my ultimate goal, then you don't have to have your phone around. And sort of why I like the Apple Watch, you know, it sort of separates you from your phone a little bit. I don't like to have my phone plugged in next to my bed at night. I like to put it in another room and not think about it anymore. So then, you know, I can turn my bedroom, my reading light on and off with the Dot, as opposed to having to, you know, use my phone to do that.
Amazon has to spend some time, it sounds like, from you and other people that I've heard that use it. I feel like I need to get one at this point because it always sounds awesome when we talk about it. But they need to spend some time on multiple Echoes in one kind of living space, because it always kind of seems like if you've got more than one, like, it makes perfect sense that you'd have more than one to control it wherever you happen to be. But then it kind of gets confused because both of them fire off or whatever. It doesn't know which one you're talking to. You got to name one thing, name the other another thing. That doesn't sound ideal, because then you've got to remember what name this room belongs to, you know.
And Sonos is synchronized, right? Your Sonos speakers, wherever they are.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So if Sonos could have that kind of digital.
You have to imagine Amazon's working on this.
Yeah.
Like, that has to be.
Somebody's working on it. Let's hope.
Yeah. All right. Coming up, we're going to take a look at how Microsoft's AI is analyzing any image you can throw to it. Maybe it won't be racist this time. But first, let's take a minute to thank the sponsor of this episode, and that's Wealthfront. You invest for the long term, for you, for your family's financial health, but trying to do that all by yourself, especially doing it right, it's complex, it's time-consuming. I should know, I've tried, it's not easy. Luckily, there's Wealthfront. Traditional advisors charge huge fees, between 1% to 3% of what they manage. With Wealthfront, you pay 0.25% a year, that's 25 basis points, zero commissions, no hidden fees at all. There's less than $5 a month. That's all you're going to spend to invest a $30,000 account. There are no additional charges for any of Wealthfront's services. You can get started investing today with as little as $500. Unlike other financial advisors, Wealthfront won't bog you down with dozens of questions. They've simplified their risk identification process, and that basically allows you to begin investing sooner. It only takes a few minutes. You can sign up at Wealthfront.com. It goes right to work monitoring your portfolios around the clock. It takes action as soon as an opportunity arises. Wealthfront portfolios are actually based on modern portfolio theory. They're designed to adjust according to your personal risk tolerance, and they stay diversified and tax efficient in the process. Wealthfront is transparent. It's accessible. You can view and track all of your accounts in one place. And now Wealthfront can track both your Wealthfront and non-Wealthfront bank and brokerage accounts that they'll provide in a summary of all your assets. You can see every trade that Wealthfront makes on your behalf, in your dashboard, on your desktop, or if you happen to have the app installed on your mobile device there too. Wealthfront manages over $2.6 billion in client assets. It's growing rapidly every day. No reason to wait. You can invest in your future today with Wealthfront. Visit Wealthfront.com/TNT to sign up and get your free personalized investment portfolio. You're going to see the custom allocation that they're going to recommend for your profile. And just for Twit listeners, if you sign up to invest, Wealthfront will manage your first $15,000 entirely free of charge for life. Join the many Twit fans who've seen huge success with Wealthfront and claim your offer today. Just go to Wealthfront.com/TNT, and we thank Wealthfront for their support.
TNT's fan of the day isn't just limited to people who watch or listen to the show. Sometimes, not often, but sometimes we hear from raccoons. Today's fan of the day is indeed a raccoon. Okay, so Freddy the raccoon is more of a Twit mascot than some random raccoon who watches the show. But that doesn't mean that Freddy doesn't deserve a seat at the table.
It's true. Either. It's true. We love you, Freddy. Yep, thanks
there
for watching.
He is watching the show.
Probably
and
watching
learning.
Right now in the other room over there.
Show us how you watch or listen to TNT, or show us how you raccoons watch. Just record a video or take a picture of yourself or your setup, post it on Instagram, Google Plus, Twitter, or Facebook. Use the hashtag #HowIWatchTNT and we will find it.
All right, so the whole take. Oh, hi, Freddie. How's it going? Sorry. Hey, you got to go away. This is showtime. This is embarrassing. All right, so the whole Tay AI thing didn't work out so hot for Microsoft. So what do they do? Back to the drawing board, I imagine. And this time, the new AI trick that Microsoft is unveiling is CaptionBot.ai. It's an experiment. So right there, you should at least be a little hesitant. It's from Microsoft's cognitive services team. You plug an image into CaptionBot.ai, and it'll analyze that image and generate a caption telling you what it thinks that it's seeing. If it does a good job, you can give it a good rating, and it learns from that input that you give. So be honest. That seems like one potential downfall here is rating it improperly. You were playing with this a little bit.
I love these Microsoft Garage things. I can't get enough of them. I'm sure people are sick of it because I just constantly like try them out and post them on Twitter because I think they're hilarious. Because I just love when technology is wrong.
This is good. This is meta here. So this is an image of this show. Mm-hmm. It's Megan, me, and Ken Denmead, Geek Dad, and
the site says, I think it's a person sitting in front of a laptop computer and they seem,
I think it's
those three emojis that I'm trying to interpret.
I think the middle one is the grinning, which we learned yesterday, not the grimace, but
not the
grinning.
The grimace, but the
Kara,
grinning.
I sent you one of Patrick also. I don't know if you got it in Slack, but I tried that out.
One of Patrick. Patrick, have you had a chance to play around with Microsoft's AI, any of them, because they're all hilarious, sometimes
not
disastrously.
With Tay. I didn't play with Tay. I think it turned racist too fast. But I've been trying lots of different images with CaptionBot. I tried at first with an image from a video game. I wanted to try and trick it initially, and it didn't work. And then I went to my Twitter feed, and I've been, as you know, in Japan, and I've been posting stuff from lots of different, you know, like cherry blossoms and food and myself doing faces, and it didn't recognize any of them. I keep getting the, I can't really describe the picture. And the one, a couple of those were very simple, like me in front of cherry blossoms. And I figured, okay, this one it has to get, but it didn't. And so I'm wondering if it's got a thing against French people now. I don't know. It's, it didn't work for me. Very disappointing.
Well, I did send one of you and it says, I think it's a man that is posing for the camera and he seems... And it was the emoji with the straight mouth.
It's so what it's doing here, so it's it has three different APIs that it's using. Computer vision API, that's identifying the components of a photograph. Bing image search API for image data, and I imagine comparison, kind of probably like increasing the likelihood that it's identifying the right thing or something like that. And emotion API for facial clues. So I'm imagining those emoji that it's popping up is a direct result of the emotion API. Yeah, you know, as with all of these AI experiments, like some of them are dead on. Most of them are just kind of hilarious. Like I think I saw one and I can't even remember. It was like of a person and it identified it as a picture of something. And that was like literally, this is a picture of something. It's like, okay, all right, you're right. This is a picture of something.
You're,
I guess you got that right.
Wrong.
Very good.
You're not wrong. Yeah.
Well, I do think that Microsoft just is, they know that these are going to be amusing and that people like me are going to think other people are going to find them amusing and then tweet them. And then that's how, you know, they spread.
Do you think they're a little more nervous this time? Like, gosh, do we hit publish? Do we tell everybody about this? Are we sure we're ready?
I don't know how this could go wrong. I mean maybe it could. I'm sure it always can. But this seems like it's a lot safer than AI. The thing about, they're always amusing, you're right, but in this case I would have been amused if it gave me a inaccurate description. And that would have been of course it's not gonna get everything, but it's fine, it's kind of funny, and yes, it's so good that they're trying, but getting the I really can't describe the picture at all. It's kind of so underwhelming. I'm really disappointed. I kind of wish that it would give me some inaccurate descriptions and silly, you know, silly things to at least say, yay, it tried.
Yes. But, something's going on. It didn't just give up.
Yeah.
Well, Patrick, thank you so much for joining us. And I know we talked a little bit about what you were working on. I was looking at your Overwatch stuff. Please tell me what Overwatch is. I know it's a video game. It's in beta, but tell me a little bit more about it so I at least can know that and, you know, be cool with the Overwatch kit.
Yeah, so Overwatch is a new video game by Blizzard, which is a big developer, which, full disclosure, I used to work with. It was now almost a couple of years ago. And I absolutely love the game. I've been trying the beta, and I do a show about that game. It's called Overwatchers. It's available on amove.tv. It's one of the many shows I do in English. And if you want to learn more about it, go and check it out. I also do, as you mentioned, the Daily Tech News Show with our good friend Tom Merritt, and I do a bunch of shows of my own about video games and international news at frenchspin.com. And if you want to follow me, I'm not Patrick on Twitter, and I try to tweet interesting stuff about Japan. I certainly have been tweeting a lot of pictures of cherry blossoms that CaptionBot doesn't recognize, apparently, so I've been doing something wrong.
Wah, wah. I'm realizing the reason I don't see many of your tweets is because I'm asleep when you're tweeting, probably. something like that.
Unfortunately, you know, the magic thing about Twitter is it stays there. And unless, of course, you use the services of that amazing company that will make everything disappear from the internet. So,
not planning
there's
on
always that
anything.
Option.
Thank you so much, Patrick.
Thanks, Patrick.
Take thanks care. For having me. I'm so glad I could join. So yeah, thank you very much too. For having me.
It's been our honor having
all right,
you on
take
today.
Care.
All right. TNT Records live every Monday through Friday at 4 p.m. Pacific, 7 p.m. Eastern, 12 a.m. UTC at twit.tv/live. You can always take part in the show by emailing us, tnt@twit.tv. You can also leave us a short voicemail at 260-TNT-SHOW and find us on Twitter. We are at TechNewsTodayTV.
If you're on Facebook, you can find us there, too. We're at facebook.com/TechNewsToday. We have videos from the show. We have stories that we talk about. Join the community. Post your questions there, too. We'd love to hear from you. And if you want to subscribe to the show, you can find all the ways at twit.tv/TNT. I'm on Twitter at Megan Maroney.
And I'm at Jason Howell. Thanks to our technical director, Kara Cole, and all the folks who help us produce this show every single day. And thanks to you for talking tech with us today. We'll see y'all tomorrow. High five with a raccoon.